Okay. What a tough act to follow, but this is kind of the way I like things, with a challenge. Let me just start by saying, let me confess, I'm an eco-modernist. Okay? I realize it's a bit like an AA session saying something like this as a result, in the aftermath of this talk. But I do think that Bruno is raising a very important challenge here. And I have to say that I'm an eco-modernist, not because I have had any long-term concern with the environmental movement one way or the other. In fact, one of the things that Bruno asked me just before I started speaking was, Fuller, what are you doing here? You have nothing to do with environmentalism, and that's pretty much right, okay? However, I am, what does interest me is actually in this notion that Bruno rejects at the outset, which is the idea of modernity. And modernity has to do with a certain conception of the human being, okay? And I think this is kind of the issue on the table. So when I read something like the Eco-Modernist Manifesto, what I'm seeing here is a certain positioning of the human being. And it is one where the human being, as it were, is kind of the dominant player in nature. And I want to say, first of all, begin by giving you my sense of modernism, because I don't believe that modernity is a myth, unless you regard every kind of self-understanding that we might have as a myth, right? So it's a kind of a story we tell ourselves to motivate ourselves. I think that's the way to think about modernity. It isn't necessarily, as it were, a correct empirical theory of how everything has gone in human history, but nevertheless, it is the thing that sort of motivates us and, as it were, is able to give us some kind of guidance with regard to when are we doing things right and when we're doing things wrong. And I think that's an interesting issue with regard to the kinds of stuff that we've been talking about here. What is right and what is wrong? Because to be perfectly honest, I think the people who are in this room pretty much can probably agree on the science at a very basic level, but then the interpretation with regard to whether it provides opportunities for us to go forward in some kind of modernist project, or whether it spells some kind of threat on the horizon that we need to recoil from, that seems to me to be the issue at stake here, right? And this ultimately, to me, reflects alternative attitudes toward risk. Right? Because risk is in itself a kind of neutral term, but of course you can think about risk as either opening up opportunities that would otherwise not exist, or thinking it as a threat that in a sense is giving you some kind of signal about what your limits are. Okay? And it seems to me that modernity embraces the first of these two paths that I've just talked about, namely that modernity treats the unknown, treats the risky as an open space for opportunity. And here I think the key thing about modernity and about what the modern worldview is about, and I think Bruno actually captured, you know, in a kind of caricatured way, what modernity is about. It is about dispensing with the past and making a clean break and then starting anew. That, there's no doubt about that. But I think one needs a little bit more nuance to this to sort of see this as a more positive position than what Bruno was trying to portray. Namely, until we get to the late Middle Ages, if you were to ask, the philosophers and so forth, what do we mean when we say something is possible? They would probably say it was probable. That is to say, there was already historical precedent. Something has already happened in the past, and whatever has happened in the past actually sets the precedent for what can happen in the future. Okay? So in that respect, we are always already embedded in the past, no matter how much forward we go. That was a very taken-for-granted attitude. You can find this in Aristotle. And this was very much the pre-modern attitude, where the past anchors all our possibilities for the future. And so when we talk about induction, right, that the future will be like the past, that's kind of what we're talking about. And that was what possible meant. But what you start to get in the late Middle Ages, and what becomes much more prevalent in the modern scientific era, is the idea that possible is something that is conceivable. And conceivable generally has to do with, as it were, thinking about things and whatever we think about may be based on things from the past, but putting them together in new ways and testing them out. And so part of what the experimental method was about in modern science was to unleash possibilities that would not normally be realized in nature if all you're doing is going on past performance. It is about opening up new possibilities, right? New things. And this is where the intervention into nature becomes a very decisive moment in the expansion of the human condition. Okay? And so it's that idea of the possible as it were, it's implicitly contained in what already exists, but it has to be unleashed. Okay? This is what modernity is about, and this is why the experimental method, in a way, is kind of the signature process by which we become modern. We experiment, we test, we try things. Some things work, some things do not. But nevertheless, of course, as we have seen over the last 300, 400 years, we have nevertheless taken humanity far away from the default positions that we started out with in the late Middle Ages. There is no doubt about that. Nobody denies that. However, there does seem to be a question about whether this has been a good thing. Okay? And my point to you here, regardless of what your theology is, and I happen to be someone who is, you know, from the Christian background and is very kind of sympathetic with the more progressive forms of Christianity, you know, sort of Unitarianism and all of this kind of stuff that gets away from kind of church control, but nevertheless takes very seriously the idea that we as humans are created in the image and likeness of God. I take that very seriously. I think that's been very much part of what the scientific project was about, right? It seems to me that we have, in effect, kind of realized this insofar as we have distinguished ourselves as a species, as a part of nature that in a way can exist in radically different ways from the rest of nature. Okay? We're not just tied down by our evolutionary origins. And I think that's a really important point that we always, and that is what makes us human, okay? That's the point, right? That is what makes us human. And the issue with regard to the future is whether we really continue to go along with that, or do we see this as, in some sense, given all of the admitted problems, catastrophes, potential disasters down the road, whether we recoil from this, right? And the recoiling is the move away from the modern. Okay, that's the way I see the situation that's before us. And the eco-modernists are people who realize that there are going to be harms, damages, you know, trade-offs. There'll be all kinds of things down the road. But nevertheless, generally speaking, this is still the way to go. That there is a sense in which human ingenuity is still a very distinctive kind of thing. And whether one wants to say it's because we're created in the image and likeness of God or whatever, nevertheless, that is the lodestone. So it's what we're arguing about here. While we're often talking in terms of, you know, the environment and how to organize it and so forth, we're really talking about ourselves. We're talking about what kinds of creatures we are and where are we going from here. And the great thing about the Eco-Modernist Manifesto is, in a sense, it kind of looks at the whole globe, the whole world, as it were, the canvas on which to project this kind of vision, okay? And I think that's a really strong point. So in a way, you know, if you want to talk about, if you want to revive a kind of humanism, eco-modernism is kind of the way to do it, okay? Now, I think this does go against certain kinds of trends in environmentalism, especially, you know, what Peter Singer and other people like that call species egalitarianism, the idea that all life forms are created equal under the, what, eyes of nature or something like that. I think eco-modernism actually denies this, okay? And in the course of denying it, though, it sets itself up for various kinds of problems. And in the remaining time I have, it looks like I have about 5 minutes, I want to lay out what I think are distinctive eco-modernist problems that, as it were, takes the modernism seriously. So in other words, it's not about going against the basic principles, but nevertheless, there are issues down the line. Now some of you may know that I've been very much involved in the recent years with transhumanism, okay? And transhumanism is very explicitly a movement that says what we ought to do is to increase maximum distance between the qualities that we have conventionally called human, so greater brain power or whatever, and the rest of reality. That in a sense, we need to just maximize those things at all cost. Even if that means we leave our biological bodies and we upload ourselves and we go off into space and all the rest of it. Transhumanism is a very visionary kind of view of things. And one of the things that transhumanism puts on the table that is interesting for eco-modernists to reflect on, because eco-modernists do share some of these kinds of values, is the idea of the indefinite longevity of human beings. Right? And very much the whole idea of reorganizing the environment is about to enable people to live longer, healthier lives and to live more productive lives and all of this kind of stuff. And so the transhumanists are very explicit about the idea that we should actually aim to live forever, never die. But one of the things that we do know from the modern era is that the longer that people live and the healthier lives that people live, the more productive lives that people live, the fewer children they have. Okay? And I look at this audience here and I look at myself and we're all middle youth. Right? This is who we are, right? And we're the ones who are the eco-modernists, and it's not surprising, right? But there is this kind of issue in the background, namely, that if you look at where the source of innovation comes from, that is to say, the incentives to open up new possibilities for action historically have come from the next generation, the young people, the new people, the people who do not carry the baggage of the past, who can in some sense begin anew. Now, the problem is we may become a victim of our own success with regard to this kind of eco-modernist / transhumanist agenda, where we have people living indefinitely in these wonderful, productive lives, and as it were, listening to the eagles forever, which seems to be the case in this part of the world, okay? I mean, I have to say every time I come back to the United States, it's like I'm 25 again. I keep on hearing the same songs. And I do think this in a way presages a kind of problem, right? Because insofar as we want to always be opening up new possibilities and being open to new opportunities, you have to provide some kind of space for new people to enter the scene. Okay, we already have a labor crisis in academia and other parts of society where the old people aren't shuffling off quickly enough because they're all able-bodied and everything. And there's a sense in which eco-modernism may exacerbate this problem, right? That this is a form of humanism that just then becomes self-embedding. So in other words, you do become a victim of your own success. I'm not worried about climate change as much as this. Because insofar as innovation requires new people, new blood, where is that in the eco-modernist agenda? You see, and at the end of the day, it is about always opening up possibilities. So that's, I think, a really important point that I think should hit home with the audience here. But there is another point, and this goes to one thing that Bruno brought up early on when he was talking about how modernity has this kind of, you know, arrow of time and we're heading all in a certain direction. And it's that presupposition that everyone on the earth, you know, who we would want to qualify as human beings, in some implicit way already shares what we're trying to do. Right, that's always been kind of, you might say, the Achilles heel of modernism, right? A certain kind of totalistic vision. Whether we're talking about capitalism, imperialism, communism, all of these things, we presume it's in everyone's interest to be like us. So what happens when they're not like us? What happens when we do have a large percentage of the human population, including the population that we think we want to help the most? The poor, so-called poor people, the people in the, you know, global south. What if these guys don't want this? Okay? Now here I would end by mentioning a book that's worth reading in this context, and that's the book called Poor Economics by Banerjee and Duflo. And what they are people who are very much interested in development aid and bringing up Africa to the modernist standards and so forth, and they do succeed to a certain extent. But one of the persistent problems, which has to do with the self-understanding of these people in Africa, and these are people who have access to mobile phones, so it's not ignorance that's the problem. Okay, so get that off the table. It's not a matter of ignorance, but it is a matter of what does it mean exactly to live indefinitely? Right? If you've got your social structures and your culture organized around the idea that people will live 40, 50 years, and then there is a generational succession, and in a way the whole narrative of the culture is organized around a very kind of specific spatio-temporal parameter, right? We live in this space and we each live a certain amount of time and then we turn it over to the next guy. Okay, that's kind of, and that is what provides a meaning, a sense of identity for people in the culture. What happens when you come along and you start saying, ha, we can double your life expectancy if you just reorganize your environment in some kind of radical way? And then you could start trading with Belgium. You know, I mean, there's a sense in which, right, there are going to, you have to imagine, especially if you take seriously that you know, if they are human beings, they have a kind of autonomous self-understanding, they're going to say no. I mean, I like watching Belgium, you know, on my TV or my mobile phone or whatever, but I don't want to turn into Belgium or Denmark or whatever, you know, turns out to be, you know, the kind of oasis of modernism. But the point is that this becomes a serious problem. What do we do with those people? Right? Do we just leave them alone and we turn them into a kind of, you know, reservation or something? You know, eco-modernist reservation where we take care of them? I don't know. You consider it a version of rewilding? I don't know. But the point is, it seems to me that historically this has been always kind of the Achilles heel of modernism, right? What do you do with the people who don't buy into your basic vision even after they have been informed about it? Right? Where ignorance can no longer be taken as an excuse. What do you do about that? Because it seems to me that one of the things that eco-modernism has very much in common with modernism is this kind of totalistic, universalistic vision, where at the end of the day, the aim is to get everybody on board in the same ship. But there, as we learn more and more about the world, we are not limiting the amount of diversity that takes place. So how do we manage that? And I think that's going to be a very serious political problem for eco-modernism, even as I do, accepting its fundamental assumptions. And I'll stop here. Thank you very much.